top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Dan Magliocco, CEO of Danone Canada. So, Kraft, one of the great fast-moving consumer goods company, what did you learn at Kraft that stays with you today?
Yeah, Kraft, I mean, there's a lot that I have to owe Kraft. I mean, I spent the better part of 15 years at Kraft and then Mondelez, which was a spinoff of Kraft. And actually, if I think about, you know, how I got to this seat, it's interesting because at each journey, there was it was almost like little chapters, I would say. Mm. So if you allow me to indulge, maybe I'll give you a few chapters.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, chapter one for me was this, what I just mentioned earlier, which was opinions matter, but experience counts, so get the facts. And early on, that was my early 20s. It was like, you know, and I had some pretty interesting experiences of trying to go on opinion against someone who's very experienced. That's not going to work. We had to bring some facts. It built up that foundation in me to understand the business. It then moved in late 20s. I was in a role, a senior marketing role. And this chapter was all about, for me, trusting your gut and stepping outside the comfort zone, because it meant leaving marketing to go into another function, and it was leading insights. And at the time, it was unorthodox. You didn't go from marketing to insights. You know, insights was there to help serve marketers. Mm. So it was a bit, you know, I would say a little ego as well. When we sat back, trusted my gut, it was the right move, because I went overnight from engaging with, the director of marketing, to now all of a sudden the audience was, I'm sitting in a boardroom with the executive leadership team, and instantly the perspective on the business exploded. They needed me there from an insights perspective, and I was able to sort of gain so much knowledge in that base and really understand enterprise. From there, I would say early 30s was chapter three, where it was lead it before you own it. And what I mean by that was I was running at Kraft. We would go from North American structures to then structures that were more country-based. So we're in the middle of this. It was a bit chaotic, to be quite honest with you. I was running a part of the beverage business in Canada. There was another part that was managed out of the U.S. So the folks in Canada were stranded. They didn't have leaders on the ground. It was very difficult for them. And I just started taking it upon myself to sort of coach and mentor them. And I reached out to my lead, who was based in the U.S., and said, look, I know you're busy. There's a lot to sort out here in the U.S. If you want, I can help you out here. I'll just help out. And within 2 months, she rewrote the structure and just gave me the whole piece. Mm. And so that was just, for me, a lesson in sort of taking empowerment. Oftentimes, we talk about giving empowerment, which I think is important. Yeah. But I think equally important is taking empowerment. So that was kind of chapter three. Chapter four. Chapter four was this notion of when you want to write the script, you get to pick the part you play. So write the script, and this was at a time when we were coming back into Canada now. Now we're moving away from this North American structure, we're coming back into Canada. And I was approached by my president at the time and offered one of the largest positions. It was to run their biscuit business, almost $1 billion. Mm. So very prestigious, you know, at Kraft and $3.5 billion. That was a big business to manage. And it was tempting, but I stood back and I asked him, I said, I've been thinking about how we run this company here in Canada. It's $3.5 billion, 5 different divisions. And I don't think there's much strategy or portfolio management, or there's innovation in how we allocate these resources. So I said, I'd like to take a role. I'd like to create a role to lead that. And he looked at me and kind of agreed. And he said, well, then why don't we try that? And it was unorthodox, but then I said, so what's the mandate? And this is where it was funny, because he took a blank piece of paper, slid it across the table, and said, that's for you to figure out. So it was a bit daunting. That was probably the single best move I made in my career that would have got me to this seat.
Yeah.
Because in that strategy role, first of all, you were exposed to the entire enterprise. You could start to think about portfolio management. You could start to think about innovation, capability building. But it also happened to be at a moment in time, I spent 5 years in that role, and it felt like it went by in a flash because we ended up divesting the pizza business and I led that for Canada. We integrated Cadbury, I led that for Canada. And then we ultimately split Kraft Canada and I was the project lead on that as well, leading that for Canada. And so three transformational projects that basically put me in line for what the end of the Kraft split, they said, go off and lead as president of Mondelez. And that was the close of that book. Amazing chapter there.
It's going back to that, they split off Canada from the US. Do Canadians buy a bit different than Americans? Like, is there some differences? And even within Canada, is Quebec a bit different than Ontario?
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
Sure, but I think the lines of differentiation are less north-south. I mean, I would argue that someone from California probably shares similar values to someone on the West Coast.
Okay.
And someone from New York's probably more similar to Toronto. Quebec's a little distinct. I would say that for sure, a little more European in its roots. So on that front, that's where the changes would be.
Okay.
So that was kind of chapter four. And then the last chapter, I would say, is what brought me here to Danone. And that one I would entitle Suck Up the Ego and Play the Long Game.
Okay.
And you might go like, why'd you call it that? You know? And it's because I had left, at the time it was 20 years between Kraft and Mondelez. So I had, you know, I've run my career off of three principles, basically. Are you learning? Do you see a clear impact that you can contribute? And do you feel a sense of belonging? And I haven't really changed a lot of organizations because those conditions have continued to be met. When I left Mondelez, one of those wasn't. I still felt like I belonged. I still felt like I could contribute. I wasn't learning anymore.
Okay.
And that was the impetus for leaving. I wasn't prepared at that moment to sort of move my family. They wanted me to go abroad. I didn't want to do that. So I ended up looking for another role. And in doing so, I made president at 43. So this would be about 48, I guess, when I was looking. It was 2017, early days. And I ended up saying, you know, I remember going in to talk to some of the recruiters and said, like, here's who I am. Here's what I think I can contribute. And this is what I need in an organization. And I literally set it up as a Venn diagram. And I said, inside this box is Danone and a few other companies. And these are the ones I'm interested in.
Okay.
And that's how I went at it. The process. So the ego thing was, there was a president in the role. I was a president at Mondelez. They were looking for a lead that could potentially succeed him, right? In short order. So there's risk to that. You know, this is an organization I don't know.
Yeah.
And I remember counseling even with my wife, and she said, suck up the ego. This is a tier one company. You know you're going to have impact. Go there and make it happen. So we did. And in 2017, we laid down a strategy. I was running, so they created a role for me.
Yeah.
Marketing, strategy, insights. They just kind of bundled whatever they could together to make it big enough. But I was given a lot of free rein on the strategy and setting up the direction for shifting Danone from a yogurt-based company based in Boucherville to a tier one national multi-category food and beverage company. Okay. And we've been on this transition for 5 years and we've doubled the business and doubled the profit.
Next up, we'll continue to ask about Danone's business model and how has it expanded from a yogurt company to more of a conglomerate.
You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada's, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Mohamed Yunus Nobel Peace Prize winner for microcredit, and Dr. Joanne Liu, International President of Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's most successful businesses. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dan Magliocco, President and CEO of Danone Canada. Dan, thanks for joining us today. Tell us about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family do back in the day when you were a kid?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here, Carl. I appreciate that. If I go back on my upbringing, I guess I would have to say I'm part of an immigrant family. So my parents came in the 60s from Italy. I'd say lower middle class. But I was born and raised in Toronto. Fairly stable upbringing, very strong work ethics associated with that. An Italian family, as you can imagine, we were surrounded by a lot of food, family, and hard work. And I think that kind of seeded a little bit in me, a bit of what's at my core in terms of the connection with people and connection with families. And it sort of shaped a little bit of who I am, for sure.
How many brothers or sisters do you have?
I've got two brothers, one older, one younger. So I had to play the middle child. And that actually taught me how to interact because the oldest one is nothing like the youngest one. And so I had to sort of play between both of them and bridge. But it's a nice dynamic, and we're still very close together in our older age right now.
What did you think you wanted to do as a kid back in elementary high school? What was your dream? It probably was not being the CEO of Denon, because that would be too obscure.
Yeah.
You know, just too random a thought. But what did you want to think you wanted to be, a chef, or what was it?
Yeah, definitely not a CEO or a president at that time. I think, for me, growing up, the outdoors were so important. I grew up on a bit of a family farm on weekends and really enjoyed that. So I really saw myself, quite honestly, spending most of my time outdoors. That was probably early teens. Later teens, as we were starting approaching university, I was more bent towards design and architecture. I was fascinated with, art. I was fascinated with design. And to this day, I love the Group of Seven and a lot of the indigenous artists that are out there. Probably my favorite, Norville Moore. So lots of those paintings in the home. Not the originals, of course. But I think then like reality kind of kicked in for me, and it was like I needed something that I knew I could come out. We were kind of coming out of a recession. So when I went to study, I went to business school. In fact, almost following in my brother's footsteps around a CA or a chartered accountant, I took a couple of courses that, and I said, that's not for me long term. I was fascinated by the marketing field, predominantly the study of consumer behavior and consumers. And so it sort of drew me into the marketing and ended up graduating from Schulich with an MBA there in 96 and joined the CPG industry, the FMCG.
Do you still go with your family to the outdoors now? Is that something you do on weekends often?
Yeah, we have I have a place personally up on Georgian Bay, which I really love. I spend a lot of time outdoors. Really just, Awenda's close by, the national park. And I just find a sense of serenity, quite frankly, when I'm able to walk through the forest, whether it's with families and friends or just on my own. It's equally enjoyable for me. I love paddling on the lake, and I just think it helps ground me and kind of keeps everything real for me in life.
During the pandemic, my wife came across something called forest bathing from Japan, and so we did some of that. I think during the pandemic, a lot of Canadians kind of turned to nature because we had no choice. Mm-hmm. We were stuck at home, but it's just something I think it helps our mental health.
Absolutely. For me, I think when I think about the COVID, and I would argue that, in the roles that we're in, we were fairly blessed through COVID. I wasn't forced to go into a plant and work and keep the operations going. Many of our colleagues at Denon, it was super inspiring to watch them go in. We had the luxury of being able to work from home. Throughout the 2 years at COVID, I was able to have lunch with my wife, every single day. That is not something that normally happens. That was very rewarding. And I think just that human connection, even though we were in a smaller cohort, allowed us to sort of stay very solid as a family, as an individual. And then being able to get outside, again, that ability to spend some time outdoors, it really does energize you.
So are you back to work in the office 5 days a week, or do you have a mixed schedule?
No, I mean, Denon has always been relatively flexible in our approach to how and where work gets done. And so I'm back maybe 3 days a week. And I kind of alternate between Montreal and Toronto. We've got, you know, obviously colleagues in both cities, and so I'll go back and forth. That allows me to change it up as well. Okay. And it's nice to enjoy, you know, both the flexibility of being in the office and also working from home when needed.
What was your first job at a university?
Yeah, the first one, when I graduated, was 92, actually. And it was a tough year back then. I remember there was only two companies that came on campus, Kraft and P&G. And I got interviews with both of them, and I got rejected by both of them. Ironically, with Kraft, 10 years later, I ended up working there for over 15 years. So maybe they needed to go back and take a look at their recruiting practices.
It was a while ago, not to rub it in. I think they probably evolved a bit.
They've evolved a bit, yes. No, but my first job was actually in the hair care industry. It was Alberto Culver. Mm. It was a company that was still founded by Leonard Lavin, who was very involved in the business. And I actually had one of my first kind of leadership lessons that it's really stuck with me to this day, to be honest with you. I was a new recruit there, a marketing assistant, you know, pretty much as low as you're going to get in the organization. And we had a president there by the name of John Stevenson. I'll never forget him. And the reason I won't forget him is because of how he made me feel. He had no need to come see me or anything like that. But I remember being there 2 months, and he walked over and for some reason took a liking to me, and took the time to ask, you know, what I thought of certain things. And it really stuck with me. And to this day, one of the practices that I have at Danone is that every new recruit that is hired, either experienced or not, I am definitely going to spend at least 45 minutes on a one-on-one call just to get to know them, not their qualifications, just to get to know them as humans. And that serves me. I think it helps me because I get energy from that. But I'm shocked, quite frankly, on how surprised they are that they've got time with me. And so we often try to sort of make the organization much more accessible, you know.
So I mean, you learn how to be a leader from an excellent leader. So that I'm just finished a book on Generation Y, and one of the things we talk about is reverse mentoring.
Yes.
So to put you on the spot here, how are you reverse mentored by Generation Z, the youngest employees at Danone?
Yeah. So, you know, meeting them all as they're coming in. I actually mentor a few of them, three or four of them. And I love those opportunities because I get enough energy. I almost feel like there's a balance of I'm giving them some thoughts on how to approach their careers and how to think a bit lateral in terms of, you know, don't be so fixated on climbing fast and, you know, look at the experiences. Talk more about career experiences as opposed to roles. Same time, I get from them this energy. They're obviously much more digitally savvy than I am, for sure. And they give me energy, and we try to, in our organization, bring that voice into meeting, because they do provide a perspective that we may not have our fingers on the pulse. But I think that can work across the age continuum. Yeah. You know, I often fear sometimes that are we losing touch with, you know, as the population ages, you know, do we have enough folks in the organization that understand that side intimately? And so we have to rely a lot on, you know, external research and things, but just like there's value in talking to Gen Zers.
Back, you know, when we started out in business, the boss was the boss, it was very hierarchical. Where today, you're the boss, but I suspect there's a lot less hierarchy and you make the decisions, but after a lot of listening.
Absolutely. And Carl, one of the things that I think might surprise you, if you sat in one of our leadership teams, one of the things that I try to push is if someone who's not on the leadership team comes in and listens to us have a conversation, it might be hard for you to figure out who runs what function. Mm. And that's because what we're trying to do is instill more of an enterprise mindset. You know, opinions matter, and people should have the ability to voice opinions. One of the lessons I learned early on is that, you know, yes, have the courage to voice your opinion, Unfortunately, sometimes though, in a battle of opinions, years of experience trump, and therefore you had to get your facts straight too.
Yeah.
So that was something. But I think in general, I would say all these little tactics, whether it's meeting with new hires, or there's another forum that I do, which is, we just call it What's On Your Mind, where we gather, and it happened through COVID. So we picked 10 to 12 people, and the reason for 10 to 12 is because it fit nicely on the screen, you know, the little pixel. Yeah. So we picked 10, we kept it to 10, and these were from diverse functions. They'd come in, and we would just talk a little bit about what's on their mind. It could be their concern around safety through COVID, or it could be we're talking to them about our business strategy, and we're just wanting to hear from them. That's part of driving that inclusive culture, I would say.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dan Magliocco, CEO of Danone Canada. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask Dan about his experience while working at Kraft.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Dan Magliocco, CEO of Danone Canada.
When I think of it just as the average Canadian, I think of yogurt, you know, like that's the thing that totally is in my mind.
Yes.
And so it's really gone way beyond that. Is that partly what you've been doing, like the company's been doing over the last 5 or 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, it came with two great companies coming together, White Wave and Danone, in North America, at least, when the acquisition went. They were almost equal weighting in the U.S., not so much in Canada. But what it did was it brought a whole plant-based business over that needed to sort of scale from the founder mentality to now tier one kind of CPG and how you scale businesses to grow them.
So tier one means that you're in all the supermarkets across the country, that sort of thing. You have wide distribution, lots of employees, lots of reach, great marketing, things like that. So what is plant-based? Do you mean, like, what do you mean by plant-based? Like, is it lettuce? Like, what is plant-based?
Sure. It's a basic question. That's okay. That's good. I mean, when we talk about plant-based in the broadest sense, you know, there's generally, when you talk about the plant-based industry, they're talking about substitutes for animal proteins.
Okay.
What we are focused on is dairy alternatives. So dairy beverages, cheese, yogurt, but it's all plant-based yogurt, plant-based cheese, plant-based beverages. The biggest part of that portfolio is the beverages, which is a Silk brand, which is the number one brand in plant-based. It's very recognized.
So is that oat milk?
Oat milk.
Yeah, I bought your product
milk.
Then.
Okay, good.
Without
Thank
realizing
you.
It.
Thank you.
But so this is a direction the world's going, because it's healthier and it's less environmentally impactful.
Yeah.
Are those the two big benefits people would see?
I would think that you know, the main impetus that people kind of move towards a more plant-based is one of two things. It's either a health, you know, need state or an environmental impact.
Okay.
And it's true that there is, you know, a larger environmental impact on dairy. I would say though that, you know, when you look at how we view dairy and plant-based, we see these as symbiotic. I mean, our dairy categories that we're in here in Canada are yogurt. And yogurt is so rich in probiotics, proteins, calcium, vitamins.
Yeah.
And it's a real important part of someone's healthful choices. The plant-based is a trend that is growing and will continue to sort of evolve. In its ways to sort of nudge folks into adopting a bit more of a plant-based diet. I would argue that, you know, potentially the need is greater in diverting the meat consumption when you look at overall carbon footprints.
Okay.
That's not to say that milk is in a higher carbon footprint than plant-based. Obviously, it is higher right now.
Yeah.
Having said that, our Canadian dairy farmers, which in the supply market, have one of the lowest carbon footprints of milk production. And a lot of it has to do with the practices on the farm, the regenerative agriculture. You know, there's more room to grow, to advance for sure, but I think we're a long ways there when you think about the Canadian dairy industry. So we're very proud of both. I think we've played an incredible role, Danone, in advancing plant-based dairy alternative adoption. You know, just in terms of the penetration of drinks. For example, our Silk brand, which you have.
Yeah.
So when you think about dairy milk, it's 94% penetration.
Okay.
It's almost in every household.
Yeah.
We've been able to grow the plant-based category to almost 40% penetration. That's quite high. Having said that, it only still accounts for 10% of fluid milk consumption, which is odd, which means there is a need to make the product more relevant from a daily usage standpoint. Let me pour it on cereal. Let me drink it by the glass. Whereas, you know, today, it's generally only consumed in those milk occasions at about 10%.
How many oats give their lives for one cup of oat milk? Like, is there actually oats in it? I mean, this is just a silly question, but yeah, there's got to be oats in it, or you're lying. But
yes.
So, like, you take oats and grind them up. I'm not you personally, but
yes.
How do you make oat milk?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, like, oat milk, I mean, many of these things, whether you're talking almonds, coconut, oat, rice, soy, and soy was the first one, right?
Okay.
It's basically extracting some of the nutrients and the fluid from that lick. You're reconstituting it in water, but you're grinding it down into a pulp. You're getting it into a consistency. You're then adding the right, you know, flavors to get the taste profiles that you need. And then you're able to deliver a beverage. Now, the beverages up until this point were not intended to mimic the taste of milk. They were almond beverages, which obviously has a distinct almond. When you drink oat, you can have a distinct oat. But things are evolving there. And we just recently launched one, which is called Silk Next Milk. And if you have a chance to try that one, it's pretty impressive. It looks like milk. It tastes like milk. It's got 30% less sugar. And the carbon footprint is easily 30 to 40% less.
So there's labs working on it. This is serious chemistry. Where did they do the research? Is it here in Canada or over in Paris, or where's the R&D done?
It happens all around the world. We've got facilities in Europe, in Paris, let's say. There's facilities in Colorado, which obviously was a big hotbed for a lot of these organizations, and where White Wave was originally based. But we also have facilities here in Boucherville, in Montreal, where we work on formulations, where we work on adaptations. We actually we've been investing quite a bit of money in the 5 years that we've had this business. We've been trying to move more of the production closer to source. Meaning, how do we think about producing plant-based yogurts in our dairy facilities? How do we bring, you know, our Silk beverages? Now, almost over 50% of all our Silk beverages comes from Canada.
Okay.
And we're both Ontario and the West. And so we're starting to bring, and it was a concerted effort. It was a concerted effort to make sure that it could also help with the overall impact, you know, logistic miles and things like that, and sustainability.
So the environment comes up on your radar as an issue fairly regularly. You were going, the supply chain, how much gas are we burning to get it here? Things like this. So it's not greenwashing, but it's something where this is just part of what you have to do these days because of consumers, because of your employees, and because you're a good company.
Well, I think I would say if I go back, it's not something that we're doing because we've seen a trend in the last 10 years and we're trying to jump on.
Okay.
I mean, when you go back into this company's origins, over 100 years ago, you can talk about Isaac Carasso. And part of his mission was to try to help children with digestive issues. And they used to sell yogurt, plain yogurt, in pharmacies back then. And in 1972, and that was a while ago, right, over 50 years, back then, our CEO, Antoine Riboud, gave a famous speech in Marseille. It's 14 pages. I've read it. It's pretty impressive in the sense that, talk about a pioneer of thought leadership, someone who challenged the status quo of conventional capitalism. He set in motion this whole economic dual project, which is about economic and social impact. So it's been ingrained in our DNA.
Yeah.
And then in 2018, we advanced it and got a B Corp certification, which I'm not sure if you know what B Corp is, but
Not entirely. So is that in Canada or globally?
It's a global, but in Canada we got certified as well.
So what is a B Corp, Dan?
So a B Corp is, you know, think of it as a certification, a third party certification, and this is about, you know, sticking to very strict guidelines around social and economic benefit. There's five key pillars under which you're audited. Governance, workers, environment, community, and customers, right? And you have to look at that and you get scored on certain points. Many, many thousands of companies have tried. They generally don't make the cut. When we first did it in 2018, we were certified, I believe it was 86 points out of 200. Over 80 gets you the B Corp certification. We then recertified, you have to recertify every 2 years. So we recertified and got 96 points. So it's a continuous journey to kind of move towards if you boil it all down, it's like, how do we move forward? It's very consistent with our dual project, but how do we move forward delivering more sustainable, more healthful, less wasteful offerings to consumers, doing it through a very transparent lens, because you have to literally put all of that up for anyone to see.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Dan Magliocco, CEO of Danone Canada. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask Dan about Danone's environmental and social missions.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Dan Magliocco, CEO of Danone Canada. Danone, is it traded on the stock exchange, I guess,
yes,
in Paris?
The Paris, yes.
So you guys actually care about profitability and share price, and the analysts call you on, not you, but the company onto the, you know, up
yes.
to the front.
Yes.
So you managed to do this and still be a profitable company.
Yes. I would say, you know, there's still pressure to improve that profitability. And oftentimes, you know, you look at some of the peer groups and are we at that level of profitability? It's, you know, it's pockets, not entirely. But what I would say there is, this is exactly what we're trying to challenge, which is you can be a business that is rooted in economic performance and still do good. And that is at the heart of the B Corp movement, which is business using its scale as a force for good. That's what it comes down to. And so it challenges us as an organization. We in actually in North America are incorporated as a public benefit corporation.
Okay.
You know, different articles of incorporation held to different standards in terms of social and economic impact. So it's ingrained in the DNA. It's ingrained in our mission. Our mission being.
And this would, like, Generation Z respond well to, and the older employees as well. Like, they go, we're doing good things in the world and taking home a salary as well.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, Carl. One of the things that I would say when I first joined, I admired Danone from the outside before I joined, and I didn't know the people, right, obviously. Yeah. What I knew was what this company stood for, what it was trying to do, what its mission was. Its mission was very inspiring to me about bringing health through food to as many people as possible. That means accessible, that means healthy food shouldn't just be for those that can afford it. It's like, how do you make it more accessible? That attracted me to. When I got to Danone, what I would tell you is that, you know, you start to see the culture from the smell of the place, right? Mm. And when you walked in there and you saw the passion of and purpose that almost filled each and every colleague that worked there. They were really passionate about the organization and they were drawn to its purpose. And as a result, I think part of that was also just the people centricity of the culture. We start every major meeting with like a safety moment because it's important for people to be safe. And it's a very inclusive culture, I would say. One of the things that was kind of unique in its governance model was a few years ago, they started this one voice, one share. So they have this innovative governance model. So we have 100,000 employees across the world. And They enlisted everyone as a shareholder because they wanted their voice to count. They set up a governance where their voices, every year we come together, they look at the strategies, they input on the strategies. So this whole notion of co-creation, and that's very inspiring, I think, for the younger generations that are coming in as well, because they don't need to sort of feel like I've got to get to a C-suite before I have a say. And that's part of the culture that we're creating here in Canada.
So strategy, no, it's not you sitting in your corner office thinking deep thoughts, which I'm sure you do, but it's something where it's a matter we co-create it throughout the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's always a bit of guardrails when you think about corporately as a global organization, where do we want to place our bets? And then you have strategies that you need to sort of, play on within the country. But this is one where we spend a lot of time as an organization, and I feel that this is part of what drives the engagement in the organization, with a clear mission, bringing health through food to many people. When you go down from there and say, okay, then what are the core strategies that we're going to have to deploy in order to bring that to life? And we spend quite a bit of time making sure that each and every individual in the organization is clear about their role, is clear about the impact they can have on their role, feels a sense of belonging, and can see their impact in those strategies.
Yep.
It's a small thing, it's a simple thing, but just trying to pull that thread through an organization can be difficult at times, and so we find ways to interact with colleagues and do that.
You recently traveled to Northern Alberta to Indigenous communities to see the impact on the ground that your partnership with the Breakfast Club of Canada is having. Why was it important for you to travel there personally, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, so it was an experience that has kind of touched me and will stay with me. As I mentioned, even just growing up, I think there was, for me, always a personal attachment in some way. I don't know how to describe it.
Okay.
To Indigenous cultures. I don't know how to describe it. I'll leave it at that. But this experience, we've had a partnership with Breakfast Clubs for 26 years. And it's all about Breakfast Club programs where they're feeding breakfast to kids, because many of them come hungry. One in three, to be exact. In Indigenous communities, it's closer to one in two. And if they're not able to eat, they're not able to think, they're not able to achieve their potential. So we visited two schools, and we made a commitment to open up new school programs every year, for a year, with the Breakfast Clubs in partnership. Going to the northern community was very moving because you saw firsthand the impact that your mission in action.
Mm.
And so even for the colleagues who weren't able to join me, who were here in Toronto, in Montreal, bringing back that story and saying, like, this is the impact we had at these schools. Because I went there actually thinking I was handing out yogurt.
Mm.
And actually came back thinking, like, my goodness, we're handing out hope here. You know, the principal came to me and sort of said, with this breakfast program, we get the attendance up, because many of them see this as one of their only meals.
Mm.
And so how do you learn if you're not able to sort of, start at least with fuel in your body? So that's a very real example, and one that we're super proud of, and we've been with them for 26 years, and I know we'll be with them for 26 more at least.
I do a column every 2 weeks for the Globe. I interview Indigenous leaders, and so I'm writing a book with some Indigenous based on the Indigenous interviews. We've done it for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And it just strikes me, some of the things you're talking about at Denon strike me as, that reminds me of Indigenous thinking.
Yes.
Though Italians, Canadians can have, it's not just, but it's their connection to the land, it's their sense of history and community. What you're saying resonates with me a bit in terms of Indigenous leadership principles.
Yes.
Just as a tentative first thought.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I mean, what I love about Indigenous cultures is the way that they tread lightly on the ground.
Mm.
And I think that we have a lot to learn from that. And I think a little bit about, maybe out of necessity, my family, when they first came over, didn't have much. And so they found ways to really make everything stretch.
Sure.
And respect, the diversity that's out there in nature. I mean, I remember working on the farm and just appreciating how the crop diversity was critical, how even though we raised animals for food consumption, our family food consumption, there was a level of respect in how you treated them that stood with me. So not everyone, you know, agrees with raising livestock for food, but it's a reality of what, you know, what's out there in society. So it's just doing it right.
So Dan, are you more of an introvert or extrovert?
Good question. I think when you look at my Myers-Briggs, I'm an EN, ENFP. So it would put me as an extrovert, but I think on certain measures, I feel like I'm kind of lively, for sure, and I get energy from people, but at the same time, I find I need to really pull away and spend time on my own. I mean, oftentimes when I'm even just making the drive from Toronto up to the lake, it's almost 2 hours, no radio, nothing. I just want silence. I could be at events. If, you know, if I'm familiar with people, I think I'm a little bit more extroverted. Yeah. If it's new encounters, I think. So I don't know. Maybe I'm somewhere in between.
We call that an ambivert.
An ambivert. Okay, I'm going to take that one away with me.
I think that's what we all have time for today. Thank you for joining us today, Dan. I would also like to take a moment to hear from our show producer, a student of mine at McGill, Gabby Horchow and Mel. Gabby, what do you think?
Thank you, Professor Moore. What stood out to me very much during this interview, as is, I'm sure, the case for all of us, is the incredible social and environmentally conscious drive of Dinnell. I knew the company was an industry leader in ESG, but I honestly was not aware of how intricately tied its public goods initiatives were to its operation and organizational culture. The company is certainly a role model for others looking to enter the field effectively.
Definitely, Gabby. Thanks again for joining us, Dan. I would also like to thank our scriptwriter, Stephanie Richet, our technical producer, Marco Campagna, and our listeners for tuning in. A la prochaine.
Hello, and welcome to another Producer's Cut edition of the CEO series. My name is Gabby Hartshorn-Mell. I am a student of Professor Carl Moore at McGill and also the producer of this show. This week, Professor Moore has granted me the opportunity to share my favorite parts of our newest episode, our interview with Dan Maliocco, President and CEO of Dinnell Canada. I am very excited to get started. I want to jump right in with comments on his first and most important lesson of leadership.
But my first job was actually in the hair care industry. It was Alberto Culver. It was a company that was still founded by Leonard Lavin, who was very involved in the business. And I actually had one of my first kind of leadership lessons that it's really stuck with me to this day, to be honest with you. I was a new recruit there, a marketing assistant, you know, pretty much as low as you're going to get in the organization. And we had a president there by the name of John Stevenson. I'll never forget him. And the reason I won't forget him is because of how he made me feel. He had no need to come see me or anything like that. But I remember being there 2 months, and he walked over and for some reason took a liking to me and took the time to ask, you know, what I thought of certain things. And it really stuck with me. And to this day, one of the practices that I have at Dinnell is that every new recruit that is hired, either experienced or not, I am definitely going to spend at least 45 minutes on a one-on-one call just to get to know them. Not their qualifications, just to get to know them as humans.
Dinnell has a great practice here. I wanted to include this anecdote because I think it says a lot about Mr. Maliocco as a leader. Someone who truly knows his team down to the newest member at the bottom of the totem pole is certainly going to be well-equipped to understand employees, delegate tasks, and build relationships more effectively, thus resulting in a higher quality output. I think this is a good strategic move as well, as those new employees coming in are likely to be fresh out of university with the most recent education and also likely to be part of a younger generation able to provide insightful perspectives that Dinnell should consider. In this next question, Professor Moore asks about the U.S.-Canada purchasing disparity.
Do Canadians buy a bit different than Americans? Like, is there some differences? And even within Canada, is Quebec a bit different than Ontario?
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
Sure, but I think the lines of differentiation are less north-south. I mean, I would argue that someone from California probably shares similar values to someone on the West Coast.
Okay.
And someone from New York is probably more similar to Toronto. Quebec's a little distinct. I would say that for sure, a little more European in its roots. So on that front, that's where the changes would be.
I wanted to add this into the producer's cut because I very much agree with it. I am from the West Coast of Canada, and I find I relate much easier to West Coast Americans than I do to those of the East Coast, or even those in Montreal and Toronto. It is nice to hear that resonates with Mr. Maliocco as well. During this interview, we also learned about Danone's acquisition in the plant-based space. Consumers make the switch to almond or oat milk for health or environmental reasons mostly. However, I was surprised to learn that Canadian dairy farmers have quite a low carbon footprint already.
I would argue that, you know, potentially the need is greater in diverting the meat consumption when you look at overall carbon footprints. Okay. That's not to say that milk isn't a higher carbon footprint than plant-based. Obviously, it is higher right now. Yeah. Having said that, our Canadian dairy farmers, which in the supply market, have one of the lowest carbon footprints of milk production. And a lot of it has to do with the practices on the farm, the regenerative agriculture. You know, there's more room to grow, to advance for sure, but I think we're a long ways there when you think about the Canadian dairy industry, so we're very proud of both.
Danone clearly has an impressive organizational culture and mission. Their initiative, One Voice, One Share, as explained in the interview, also demonstrates this sentiment. However, it can be a challenge to balance such an open discussion with structural decision-making. Danone implements an interesting strategy to tackle this.
There's always a bit of guardrails when you think about corporately, as a global organization, where do we want to place our bets? And then you have strategies that you need to sort of play on within the country. But this is one where we spend a lot of time as an organization, and I feel that this is part of what drives the engagement in the organization. With a clear mission, bringing health through food to as many people, when you go down from there and say, okay, then what are the core strategies that we're going to have to deploy in order to bring that to life? And we spend quite a bit of time making sure that each and every individual in the organization is clear about their role, is clear about the impact they can have on their role, feels a sense of belonging, and can see their impact in those strategies. Yep. It's a small thing, it's a simple thing, but just trying to pull that thread through an organization can be difficult at times, and so we find ways to interact with colleagues and do that.
I think that is a nice way to end off. Thank you very much for tuning in to this mini episode of Professor Moore's CEO Series. It has been an honor to share my ideas with you. Thank you very much to Professor Moore for allowing me the space to contribute my thoughts. As always, à la prochaine.